Welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry and she is Emma Bunnell.
Hello.
So, not many of us want to relive COVID and the height of the pandemic, but of course, so much happened. And it's quite right that there is a public inquiry into what happened. And that is really gathered steam this week. I actually wonder, I don't know what you think about this, Emma. I slightly fear that given everything going on in the world and just general politics and just the general media environment, the importance of this has rather been lost. There's been some quite big gotcha moments, particularly this week, and we'll come to them. But I do think this is rather going under the radar. So I'm very pleased to have a chance to dig into it a bit with you.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think there's been, with anything like this, there's going to be parallel tracks. There's the straight gotcha. Oh, my God, they're all swearing like navvies.
I think that's a bit disingenuous to navvies, actually, but we'll get to that.
They're all, you know, what a shambles they were, kind of immediate story. Mm-hmm. The longer term story is the deeper, more important work that the public inquiry is set up to do. And that doesn't lend itself to 24/7 news.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. And I think that's why some of it has been missed. I agree with you on that entirely. I want to, and because of that, I actually, and because we are, of course, the only and the best female-fronted political podcast in this country, I want to start with a question I don't think anyone else is asking, really. Was there a women problem in government? Let's break this down, because, first of all, a lot of the stories revolve around men. The only senior woman, as far as I can tell, particularly this week, that we've seen is Helen McNamara, who was the second most senior civil servant at the time, I think, if I've got that right, very senior civil servant. And some of the language used about her by Dominic Cummings, let's just start with that, in text messages, is so outrageous that even you wouldn't read it out on this podcast.
I would, but you wouldn't let me.
No, I would edit it out, that's true. Let's be honest. But, you know, he calls her an absolute disgraceful word that you and I cannot. Yeah, I just can't imagine. He talks about dodging stilettos, like just very misogynistic language. So there's one element of that. And I messaged you about that yesterday and you came back to me with what I think is the more important point, which is, yes, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, but one day maybe our WhatsApp will have to face a public inquiry and you can see all the different things Emma corrects me on. But the more important point, and you raise this and you're entirely right, was actually it's not about, you know, some horrible language or even people being rude in the room, but the amount of women that were in the room and what that meant was discussed. So you pointed out, for example, that there was PP that didn't fit women's bodies during the height of the pandemic. For me, one of the big issues was that it took forever in lockdown for anyone to think about what that might mean for domestic abuse victims, which are obviously predominantly women,
and not just what it meant for those women who were already being targeted with domestic abuse, but the fact that many men under more stressful conditions slipped into domestic abuse.
Yes, absolutely right. All those things, what did it all mean? And often it becomes very clear if you read the messages, if you see what was prioritised and what was talked about, there were just not enough women in the room giving the perspective of the policy decisions for women. I saw one story and I may, here's my maybe not agreeing with it entirely. But there was obviously, there was concern, for example, there was so much talk about football. And what was going to happen with football, I guess, at all tiers, as opposed to perhaps what others would consider more important things. Now, actually, you'll laugh at this, but for me, one of the moments where I found, you know, I think you and I both lived alone during lockdown, it was very, very difficult. But one of the moments that sort of gave me a sense of normality was when football returned. And that got my rhythm back of like watching things in the evening or whatever else. And so I don't want to undermine that it is important for certain people. It's a huge industry as well. It's an economically important issue. But do I think it is the top priority in a global health crisis? No, of course I don't. And you need to allocate time and discussions appropriately. So, I do think this women issue is a very serious one.
Yeah, I think there were also quite a lot of things that happened when various tiers were set in train, when different types of businesses were allowed to do different types of things. There was a lot of concern that predominantly female-led industries, such as beauticians, hairdressers,
yes,
services, were vastly under thought about in all of those things. Equally, many of those women are likely to be freelancers, but not have the kind of freelance contract that allowed them to get furloughed.
Yeah, I mean, the whole freelance thing, as you and I both remember, was absolutely abysmal the way that was handled. It was, people disappeared through the cracks very quickly. Lots of people were, you know, not happy, but coping with furlough and on furlough, whereas freelancers, the world sort of collapsed overnight.
Absolutely.
And you're right to say that.
Haven't properly recovered at all.
Yep.
And, you know, it is equally, when you're a freelancer, the post-pandemic squeeze, the cost of living crisis, yep, is still hitting us in ways it's not hitting the salaried.
Yeah. Just to return to what we heard at the inquiry over the last few days. So Helen McNamara, this is a story in The Independent, said the atmosphere around the discussions, particularly in early 2020, those meetings in early 2020 were, and this is a quote from her, confident and macho. She said, she told Boris Johnson that the country was, again, a quote, heading for disaster. Now, if you read the descriptions of Matt Hancock's behaviour, I think macho, confident and macho sounds appropriate. I think that's always appropriate for the way Dominic Cummings behaves and, you know, trying to assert things. And my time is so, read, he often in these text messages complaining about his, how his time is being used as if he's the prime minister. You know, so there's a lot. He did, I should say, apologise for some of the language he used about Helen McNamara and said he was was just as rude, if not more so, about male colleagues, which I'm not sure is the best excuse I've ever heard. But anyway.
Not the greatest reason.
Anyway, Helen McNamara also said,
I'll see you next Tuesday.
I mean, seriously. Helen McNamara also said that she felt female staff were talked over and ignored, and there were bad behaviours tolerated from some of the more senior people. It's all pretty damning.
It is all pretty damning, but it's deeply unsurprising. And I think I tweeted when the Times first said, oh, yeah, there's going to be loads of misogynic language. Like, you're telling me that Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson are sexist? This changes everything.
Yeah.
No one is shocked by the fact that these two macho idiots are macho idiots.
Well, I don't think there was only two, and that's the problem.
But I mean, culture is set from the top.
Yes.
And it was the same under David Cameron's government, a different type of blokiness, but still very, very blokey. And there is a problem, certainly. I mean, there's a problem in wider society, so we shouldn't be surprised that it's replicated in Whitehall. But there is a problem where if you have a very homogenous group of largely white men making decisions, their life experience that leads to their thought processes are going to be different from those of people who are of colour and women.
I think there is a general problem in politics. I think this is sort of what you're getting at, that there's never enough women in the room, there's never enough women in the WhatsApp group, there's never enough women going, have you thought about this? I think that is a very serious point because it has serious policy implications. And though, you know, sometimes you can bumble through when it's, you know, not so serious issues. At the height of a massive public health crisis, that stuff really, really matters. And I think what we have seen this week is how much it can matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're talking about public health, you have to remember that 50% of that public are women.
Who have very different bodies,
very different needs. You know, some of the stuff about women giving birth during COVID, for example, horrendous.
It was absolutely abysmal.
Yeah, and just as you say, it felt like an afterthought.
Yeah, I mean, I had friends who gave birth during the pandemic or had very young children during it. It was horrendous. And it just seems from this, look, those are not the things that we saw in the inquiry that have come out this week. But you can tell from what we have seen how those type of things would not have been disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it. It's not about whether, you know, those things are the things that have come in evidence this week. It's what's come in evidence this week laid the ground for those lack of perception.
I just find it impossible to come to any other conclusion.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had Dominic Cummings on, I was going to say on the stand. It felt a bit like that. We've had Lee Kane, who was running comms. They all highlighted an absolute shambles in the structure of government. Dominic Cummings sent a message to Boris Johnson on the 12th of March, 2020. Think about that date. The message read, we've got big problems coming, cabinet office, terrifyingly expletive, no plans, totally behind on pace. Lee Kane said the point was nobody quite knew who was the point person, who should be driving the machine. If you ask me now who was supposed to be doing that, I couldn't tell you.
Isn't it?
You would think so. There is a story that has...
Buggered off to write his book, which still hasn't come out. But I really hope that whoever that idiot publisher was that gave him a massive advance for a Shakespeare book has got their money back.
Yes. What you're referring to is it appears that Boris Johnson went off grid for what, 10 days, I think. Was it February 2020? So really at a crucial point for trying to get things in order. I think there is a general point that is coming out from messages and comments from Cummings and Kane that Whitehall itself is a bit shambolic. Dominic Cummings has always obviously had this agenda, you know, when he tried to build his control centre in Whitehall, all that kind of thing. I think there is a salient point there that the structure of government in the UK is a bit chaotic. I think that is a reasonable point, whether you like the people making it or not. But I also think...
That would be the case, though. I mean, I think definitely the civil service has been deeply undermined and hacked away at for the last decade or so, which probably has led to more chaos. But I don't think anyone thought, oh, God, government's so chaotic and unstructured under, you know, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Margaret Thatcher, John Major. That wasn't the problem.
No, that's a fair point. But obviously these things become really exposed in a crisis.
Yeah.
But what
I don't want there to be is a perception that that's just how government is. That was a deliberate choice to undermine government and undermine the civil service and cut it down. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
No, but also just having more money going through the civil service doesn't mean that you, A, to use the phrase in this message, know who the point person was. And I think that bit is what you can specifically blame on the government of the time.
Yes. Look, we had a chaotic idiot running a chaotic government. There are two parallel stories, one of which, and two parallel lessons. First lesson, never let Boris Johnson be Prime Minister again. I think this country's learned that one. Second lesson, you have to have decent structures. And if you undermine those structures for a decade, you will not have decent structures when the emergency, whatever it is, and next time it will be a completely different emergency, but there'll be one, inevitably comes.
Yeah, I do find it hard to disagree with that. I know a lot like you, I know lots of people that work in the civil service, and you know, they're all good, diligent people who want to do a good thing. I do also think when you hear about some of the processes and the faffing around that goes in the civil service, it can be a bit like, oh, come on, just get stuff done. But as a general rule, I think this whole notion of the blob trying to stop things getting done is probably a bit oversold and a bit unfair.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, processes matter.
Yeah, you're much more into this. You're much better at org charts and you're much better at this stuff than me. You're much more reasonable at this stuff than me.
So when I was running a team of, I think, five or six, my catchphrase, as it turned out, I didn't know it was until they pointed it out to me, was if you fell under a bus, would I be able to know what you've done? And yeah, I said this apparently so often to the point that they started worrying I was going to start pushing them under buses.
The buses, yeah.
But it is important because, you know, we talk about silo government. And generally what we mean in that is that departments don't talk to each other.
Yep.
We also need to make sure that within departments, people are aware of the work each other is doing. And that's why a point person is important, so that you know where the flow of that organization goes to. But if you just had a point person and no flow, that would be equally chaotic.
So the title of this episode is going to be Emma Agrees with Dominic Cummings.
Over my dead body.
Well, that was an unfortunate segue, because there was some other stories that emerged during this week. Matt Hancock, Sir Simon Stevens, who was the head of NHS England, said Matt Hancock, quote, wanted to decide, quote, who should live on and die, which is a terrifying thought. Sir Simon told the Inquiry the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care took the position that in this situation, by which he means hospitals being overrun, rather than say the medical profession or the public should ultimately decide who should live and who should die. I don't know what that means in practice. I suspect Matt Hancock wouldn't be going around turning off people's ventilators, but I don't know if it means, you know, someone over 85, you don't treat them. Someone under 65, you do. I don't quite know what that means, but it's a rather terrifying thought. And I think it goes back to this idea of macho.
Let's given that we're a politics podcast, let's look at...
Oh, are we? Is that what we're doing?
Fascinating thing. So in 2012, Andrew Lansley's disastrous NHS reforms, one of the key components of that was to take the Secretary of State out of responsibility. That's one of the major...
Responsibility for what?
Responsibility for operational decision-making.
Right, yes.
So the idea was that you would never have to have a Secretary of State going onto the television if something like Alder Hey happened again, because they were not responsible. It would be Simon Stevens who was responsible. Since then, it was quite clear that was never going to happen, because political accountability and responsibility is part of what we see of as our democratic
way. I agree with that.
So it kind of got reversed. But Hancock has clearly taken it so far in the other direction that he thinks you should be making all the operational rather than the political and policy decisions. And that, again, is too far the other way.
Yeah. I'll just add another quote from Sir Simon before I come back on what you're saying. He said, I certainly wanted to discourage the idea that an individual Secretary of State, other than in the most exceptional circumstances, should be deciding how care would be provided. Now, there is a legitimate case that this was the most exceptional circumstances. But even so, he's not working on the ground in a hospital, Matt Hancock. And I find that idea quite terrifying. I mean, ultimately, he would have to have sign off, because you're right that public democratic accountability matters.
He has sign off on things like, here are the guidelines for NICE.
Sure.
The people who decide which drugs we can and can't.
Yeah.
He does not make the decision over whether Mrs. Miggins
can have a ventilator or not. Yeah. There's another interesting thing which leads me to the sort of ultimate point I want to make, and where I think we're going to more fundamentally disagree, because so far we've been playing rather nice. There are some rather interesting messages that emerge over time from various people showing a wobbling on this policy of lockdown. So, for example, Boris Johnson very clearly got fed up with it.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson's, I think, got frustrated. He was worried about basically older people that were dying. So why are we locking down the whole country? Dominic Cummings made the point that basically there was no shielding plan in place, which is appalling. There was obviously a lot of the issues that have been come out and are coming out during this inquiry about what happened in care homes, which I think is of fundamental importance. Here's in the Telegraph live blog, they said Johnson did not understand the difference between minimising mortality and minimising overall spread. I think we have to bear in mind, as I'm reading these messages and these comments, the difference of knowledge at various points. So what people said in March 2020, what they thought in July 2020, what they thought in January 2021, it could legitimately change because we had different knowledge about the virus. And obviously, vaccines changed the game again completely.
We were all wiping everything with antibiotic at that point, weren't we?
Right. Okay. And do you know what I mean? So times have changed. I think that's fine. And we should bear that in mind. But...
antibiotic,
yeah, antiseptics, yeah. Mark said, well, and Sir, I think Sir Chris Whitty, they had a message that said, thanks for making the time, good to see you. I was very struck by your point about differential mortality rates between healthy and sick. I don't think the PM and co have internalized yet the distinction between minimizing mortality and not trying to stop most people getting it. And then this is Mark said, well, indeed, presumably like chickenpox, we want people to get it and develop herd immunity before the next wave. We just want them not to get it all at once, and preferably when it's warm and dry. So alongside the measures to achieve that, our driving focus should be on those most likely to die of it. Agree? So Chris Whitty replied, exactly right. We make that point every meeting, even if they don't quite get it. This is interesting. Because, again... March the 12th, 2020, very early on, still a lack of knowledge and a going on. But that's a herd immunity strategy that is essentially letting us all get COVID to carry on and hoping by September it's all over. What's your take on that?
I think there's a bit of memory holding about why we locked down.
Okay.
Going on.
You're setting me up beautifully, by the way, so please continue.
We didn't lock down to stop everybody getting the virus. We locked down to stop everyone getting the virus very, very quickly in a way that would mean that the numbers of people who were getting it and suffering severely would overwhelm the NHS and mean that nobody could be treated. That was why we locked down. We didn't... lockdown to stop you or I getting a mild case of COVID, both of which I think we've had.
Well, I've never tested positive for COVID. She says, touching lots of wood, because if I'm ill next week, I'm going to blame you. But I certainly had it right at the beginning. And I think I got it at the football, ironically. I certainly had a few days where...
November 2022. When did I see Madness? I think it was November 2022. I got it before I went to see Madness. And then I think I've had it at least once since then, but I didn't test, but it was quite clearly COVID. But I think there are several, we saw what was happening in Italy in March 2021.
And that's what tipped people over the edge here.
And the other thing that is worth remembering, when certainly the more vocal anti-lockdown people start blethering on at you, is that...
I'll stand by on that.
Britain locked itself down.
Yes, this is a very important point.
For formal lockdown, nobody was going to the pub. We were staying in our homes.
Yep.
In fact, I think from some of the stuff that I've read from the inquiry, it was that self-imposed discipline that turned the government around on the idea that the British public would accept a lockdown.
Yes. I'm nodding enthusiastically because you're absolutely right. If you look at the data from the week or two before Boris Johnson's first TV address, it's very clear people have made their own decisions.
So, look, lockdowns were messy, poorly managed, appalling to live through, horrendous for people under more difficult circumstances than me. Horrendous enough for me, frankly. My mental health has never fully recovered. But there was a reason to go into them. Certainly the first and second lockdowns, but the second lockdown could have been either of them.
What are you counting as the second lockdown? The Christmas one? Christmas not one. The bit in the middle where everyone else couldn't go, but everyone could go to school. You're not counting that?
Not really, no.
Okay. I just want to be clear. I'm not picking at bones. I just want to be clear.
Yeah, yeah. No, I count the second lockdown as the Christmas lockdown. That could, if that had happened earlier, shorter and sharper, it could have been avoided being what it was. But there was so much gung-ho, we're going to reopen Britain bullshit going on in government that they got high on their own supply.
Okay. There's two things I want to come back on a lot of this because you've set me up beautifully. I just need to make one correction. I attributed those comments before to Sir Chris Whitty. They're actually from Sir Christopher Wolmad. He was the permanent secretary at the Department of Health and Social Care. I was going through some of the... So anyway, just want to be clear about that. Okay, on lockdown. I think it is... First of all, your point about people's own decisions is entirely correct. I remember very distinctly going on the tube in early March 2020, popping into shops and stuff, and then getting off the tube for the last time and going, this is ridiculous, I'm not doing this anymore. I'd made my own decision, and millions of Brits had made a similar one if they had the luxury of doing so. Some people still had to plough on and go to work and this and that. Anyway, so I think it is, that point is right. And I think it is probably indisputable that we had to do that in March 2020, whatever people who are more anti-lockdown than me say now. I think you used the phrase memory holding, and I think people have forgotten how the lack of knowledge we had, the fear people had.
I remember being so frightened.
Right.
Walking to the supermarket, mask on, gloves on, standing 2 meters apart, queuing for 2 hours and crying and just feeling so frightened and alone.
Yes, absolutely. And people have forgotten how little we knew about this virus and how scared we were about it. And so I accept the need for that first lockdown. But I really think there was no choice and it probably needed to be formally done earlier. That might have, if nothing else, it set the tone, that slight delay for everything else that happened, which comes back to some of the stuff we've seen in the inquiry about how government was run. What I find harder to keep going was the faffing in the middle months that you can see six people.
Oh, yeah. The tears absolutely drove everyone in local government completely mad.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And no one really understood them. They were very, very hard to enforce. They were very hard for the public to self-enforce, to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think people slightly overplay that. But yes, as a general, it was a mess. And I think what we've seen from the inquiry is why such messy situations arise. You had a prime minister who was desperate not to impose national lockdowns. You had a chancellor who was looking at the bank accounts going, oh my God, which I understand. And
yeah, I mean, economic decision-making has to be part of this.
Of course it does. And you had an increasingly miserable and frustrated general public. So all of that is going on. I do find it harder to deal with that middle bit. I think, swing towards supporting that final Christmas lockdown for the simple reason that I think it made the vaccine programme more effective. And I highly support the vaccine programme. It was the only real exit route. And I think it was so miserable that Christmas. But I think... And the January and February afters, if we're being honest. But what I think it did was obviously it stopped some people getting COVID and therefore meant they could get a vaccine instead of actual COVID.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there may be a scientist with some data that tells me I'm wrong, but that's my instinct. But that middle bit and the way it was managed and the frustration that people felt was abysmal. And the niggling and the interfering in people's lives for things that were not making a real difference was unforgivably ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, God. People getting arrested for having a walk on the Derbyshire Moors or something.
Because they dared to have a coffee in their hand at the same time. All that stuff.
I think also one of the real injustices is people in Downing Street getting a 50 quid fine and some poor 18-year-old student being fined £16,000.
Yeah, I mean, this part of the inquiry hasn't even dealt really with Partygate, although we should point out Helen McNamara supplied the karaoke machine.
Oh, the karaoke machine, yeah.
Anyway, so I think
her karaoke standard is it wasn't me.
Oh, God, Emma. And there's another point I want to make before we finish up, and it's about the inquiry in general. I think in this inquiry, it has come from a starting point that we should have locked down faster, harder, for longer, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the only outcome it is going to find. And
I don't know about the for longer.
Okay.
Harder might have avoided for longer. And I think that's
fair point.
Often missed by anti-lockdown people.
Fair point. That's a very fair point. But I think that is going to be the outcome. That if Boris, that if we'd have locked down, fine, if not longer, faster and harder, things might have been better. And I think it's very dangerous to go into an inquiry basically with a preordained outcome. And I would like to see more on the inquiry about the negatives of lockdown, the toll it took on people, the financial impact. And I don't think we're getting there. And I'm really, really concerned about that.
See, I think this again comes back to the problem I was talking about at the very, very top of this episode. This inquiry is being run in modules.
Correct.
This is the module on what happened during that decision-making process.
Correct.
There are other modules to come. And the problem with this modular approach, the benefits of it is that people are getting answers more quickly on some things, particularly the COVID families and people like that. Mm-hmm. The negative of it is that we think, oh, well, it's making this decision, it's making that decision, and it's not looking at this and it's not looking at that. Well, it will. It's just doing it in a whole load of different modules. Public inquiries are slow shit.
Yes, yes.
And unfortunately, journalism wants a jet ski.
It's not that I want a jet ski. I can just see, and you're right to point out there's modules and we should remember that. But the way it is set up, the way it is structured, the way these questions are already being asked in both the modules we've had so far, I think that is somewhat preordained. I see no discussion, and I don't think we will see real discussion about the negatives and the toll of lockdown. And I think that's really important. And if we don't get to that, I hope I'm wrong. I hope we can come back in another 6 months.
You probably are wrong. I think there's enough pressure on them to do that. And particularly when it comes to children's education and mental health. I don't think that's avoidable.
Okay, so it might not be. I don't think it will discuss, okay, the toll on you and I, two single people. I don't think we're going to have that discussion.
It's not going to be about us, sadly.
I think it should be. I don't think there's going to be enough on the toll of lockdown. I really don't. You and I might do a show in 6 months or a year when this has gone further down the process and I'm wrong. Great. I suspect I'm not going to be, though.
Well, we shall see. Hopefully you are wrong.
Hopefully I am wrong. I would like to be wrong. Absolutely. I'm just not convinced I will be. Just a couple of things to wrap up. Pardon?
Are you ever convinced you're going to be wrong?
No. Well, I never am. We obviously, there's a few other bits.
Overconfidence.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be one I think you'll like, which is Professor Chris Whitty referring to Eat Out to Help Out as Eat Out to Help the Virus. It'll be interesting if this bounces back on Rishi Sunak, any of this stuff from the inquiry. I have to tell you, I found a bit of relief. I understand the concerns about Eat Out to Help Out, but I found a bit of relief in that period of time where sort of people were going out for dinner stuff. We were all so desperate at that point.
We were. I don't think you had to do it in that way. I think people were going to go out anyway.
And I think you have to remember how desperate the hospitality industry was.
Absolutely. But actually, the people I speak to in the hospitality industry say Eat Out to Help Out just artificially bump them for a few months. And actually, there are much, much more endemic problems that they're
doing. Yeah, and also, I think it basically moved the people that would have gone out on a Saturday night, just moved them to a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Exactly. Which actually, in terms of planning catering, can be quite complicated.
Sure. So anyway, that I thought you would like that little gambit from Professor Chris Whitty. I mean, there's all sorts here. We could discuss it for hours, but we won't. It's been quite depressing to relive those years, year or so. There's going to be a lot more that comes from this inquiry. It really is worth paying attention to. As I say, I'll be fascinated to see the pushback on Rishi Sunak as well, because I think that will matter. Anyway.
Yeah, we've said before, I've said many, many times, Sunak got his popularity from being the COVID chancellor. That the tarnish may bounce back even on that former reputation.
Maybe, yeah.
Will be interesting.
Let's end on a positive, Emma. It's our birthday next week.
Happy birthday to us.
Happy birthday to us. November the 11th. We have been doing this show for a whole bloody year. Yay! How about that?
I mean, you're a parvenu. You're a newcomer, because I've been doing the show a lot longer than 11.
Well, indeed. I'm just the sort of Johnny come lately to this all. But anyway, we will be celebrating appropriately. Let's just leave it at that for now. And all of you listeners will, of course, be going to Emma's play.
Which
we'll leave the details in the show notes. Where else can people keep up with you, Emma?
So in addition to coming to Venom, 14th to 18th of November at the Golden Goose in Camberwell, you can read my Substack newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left, and find me less and less often these days on the various social media.
Yep. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across the various social media networks. You can head over to theaddition.net to read my blog post, sign up for my newsletter there, come hang out. Please be in touch with us. We love to hear from you, even on the sort of burning carcass that is Twitter. We love to hear from you at HOC Podcast. So do be in touch with us there. And we'll see you all for a birthday party next week.